This is John Howell, Essential Cuts, your daily rundown of the best of the best from today's show on 890 WLS.
Greetings and salutations. Good afternoon. All hands on deck here at WLS this afternoon. DEFCON 1, the Queen has died, Pardon my cynicism. I should be able to control it, but I can't. But, and I no disrespect to Kim Gordon, she's in the newsroom. And I don't know if it was Kim who said this. And Kim, good afternoon. I hope you're doing well.
Hi, Jen.
Or somebody in the report. But they said, we're all shocked by the sudden death of Queen Elizabeth. How is it at age 96, it's sudden?
Yeah. You know, I agree with you on that. But just 2 days ago, she just met the new prime minister, you know. So she was working up until 2 days ago. So it seemed like it happened very quickly, whatever it was. You know, she has been in failing health for the past few months and has not attended, you know, some of her
Jubilee. Yeah. She missed some of her Jubilee.
Yeah, yes. She did. And other things. And her husband died not too long ago. So
do you know why she stayed home for the Jubilee? Because she wanted to. After what, 70 years or whatever she's
70
been?
Years. She has that prerogative.
Yeah. I've had enough. I don't want to get dressed for this. Tell him I send my best. Thank you. I'll watch it on TV. So, you know, Stephanie Tishner, our program director, called me. Not in tears, but quite emotional because the Queen meant so much to her. And she said to me, don't you remember that marvelous speech the Queen gave to the UK? And we heard a lot of it here in the United States as well, because we have a fascination with the royals that I can't quite figure out why, but we do as a nation. That magnificent speech she gave at the beginning of COVID, so from 2020...
I'm speaking to you at what I know is an increasingly challenging time, a time of disruption in the life of our country, a disruption that has brought grief to some, financial difficulties to many, and enormous changes to the daily lives of us all.
It was a magnificent speech. And essentially, it comes down to the English saying of keep calm but carry on, a buck up.
I hope in the years to come, everyone will be able to take pride in how they responded to this challenge. And those who come after us will say the Britons of this generation were as strong as any, that the attributes of self-discipline, of quiet, good-humoured resolve, and of fellow feeling still characterize this country.
Going to catch up with Em Nguyen. She's at the White House in D.C. here in just a couple seconds regarding the president's plans to travel and how big our delegation might be. Kim Gordon, do you know who today's luckiest newsmaker is?
I'm thinking former President Trump or Steve Bannon.
Steve Bannon, you're mm-hmm. absolutely right, because his perp walk has been blown off cable news and the front pages. Of course, Steve Bannon's modus operandi, his business model, is to always be in the news to churn those donations, obviously, so perhaps this is a bad miss for him. You know, in my opinion, who today's unluckiest newsmaker is?
Bernard Shaw,
who is this year's Farrah Fawcett, was unlucky enough to pass away on the same day as somebody much, much, much bigger. You'll remember when Michael Jackson died. We had heard earlier in the day that Farrah Fawcett died, and that was it. No more Farrah Fawcett because Michael Jackson was dead. And today I woke up to the fact that Chicago's own distinguished newsman of decades, he was just a great journalist, he had died, and I thought, well, we better talk a bit about Bernard Shaw today. And the next thing you know, Stephanie's saying, no, play more of the Queen's speech.
The pride in who we are is not a part of our past. It defines our present and our future.
Let's go to D.C. now. Em Nguyen joins us from just outside the White House regarding any sort of announcement from the White House. Em, thank you very much for your time. I know you're very busy. Any announcement from the folks at the press shop there regarding travel to the UK?
You know, so far right now, all we know is that the president has sent out a statement earlier today before the news even came out. We had reporters asking the White House press secretary whether or not the president had plans in place to travel if something like this were to happen, and we have yet to hear any details. So far, all we know is that the president says the Queen was more than a monarch. She has defined an era. He says that she was a stateswoman of unmatched dignity who deepened the bedrock alliance between the UK and the US. He also mentioned that the Queen several times He had met her in person several times, including once in 1982, while he was still just in the Senate. Again, in 2021, he says that she has always charmed them with her wit and her wisdom. He also went on to mention, of course, is that the acknowledgement that King Charles III is going to be taking over as the leader in the monarchy. And he said that he is looking forward to that friendship between the two countries and, of course, with the king as well.
Any idea how big the delegation would be from the U.S. to go to the official funeral and services for Queen Elizabeth? I assume it might include ex-presidents as well.
It certainly could, and we have been hearing from former presidents and former first ladies as well, sharing their condolences. The thing we have to know is there's a few steps to look forward to, and it's going to take some time. The first step is, of course, King Charles is going to be traveling the UK. He's going, of course, immediately now becoming the king, he's going to be establishing those new connections with other leaders. This includes, of course, the president as well. Then we're going to have to look forward to what's happening in terms of the funeral. There's going to be the lying in state. There's going to be the burial or the queen being laid to rest. But then there's the question of when the coronation could take place, which is, of course, the time in which many leaders and world leaders, maybe even people in the congressional delegation, could be going overseas to honor the new king. And this could take place maybe in the next few months. It could be even over a year. Remember back when actually the queen had her coronation, this again was 70 years ago, it took about 14 months after the passing of her father before that coronation actually did happen. So we will be looking forward to see what kind of communication lies next for President Biden. But certainly that next big thing would be lying in state, being laid to rest for the funeral arrangements, and then, of course, the coronation of the king.
At your shop, ABC News in D.C., what kind of reaction today to the death of the queen? We're running the gamut here at WDLS Radio. Some people are quite emotional. Others are like, well, she was 96. Is it much the same at the ABC News Bureau?
Well, certainly we have been preparing for something like this for some time. But the thing is, we just saw the Queen a couple of days ago when she was appointing the new prime minister. That was her last photo op, and she was smiling. She had a twinkle in her eyes, what one of the correspondents said about that picture. And now, 2 days later, she is pronounced dead. And so certainly it comes as a shock. There's an outpouring of condolences. Many correspondents who have covered the Queen say that it was just an honor to be able to cover her in the past. The way she carried herself, the way she visited foreign countries and foreign leaders, that helped shape what the monarch was supposed to be. And certainly some of the correspondents here say it was just an honor to be able to cover the Queen. Because, you know, if you think about it, John, there's not many world leaders who have this sort of respect and the ability to be loved the way the Queen was all these years.
Em Nguyen, thank you for your time this afternoon. Much appreciated. We'll call in your expertise again.
Thanks so much.
We will succeed. And that success will belong to every one of us. We should take comfort that while we may have more still to endure, better days will return. We will be with our friends again. We will be with our families again. We will meet again.
By all accounts, a very, very nice person and pretty good at her job.
You're listening to John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
Now, Ed Burke always joked about it. Regarding leaving the Chicago City Council, very few people get out of this job, and when they do, it's by the ballot box, the jury box, or the pine box. And Alderman Brookins has been trying to get away from the City Council for years, it seems. Ran for state's attorney in 2008, Congress in 2016, judge earlier this year. So let's get the inside scoop here on this story. A.D. Quaig writes on politics for the Chicago Tribune and a returning guest here. A.D., how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Well, I thought your piece on Brookings was terrific. He said he wants to hand the baton over to a new generation of leaders who can make sure the movement for racial justice and economic equity is sustained into the new political era. Can you kind of unpack that for us and describe in his mind what the alderman thinks his legacy will be?
So I spoke to him this week right after the announcement. He basically said, I was able to bring a lot of businesses to my ward that wouldn't have come otherwise. The most prominent of these as folks who've been in Chicago for a while will remember, was he was very early on an advocate for letting Walmart into the city of Chicago. He was a big fighter for that. Did not get the first one, did get the second, but then went on to bring Lowe's and a few other big box stores to his ward. He also said, you know, I renovated our library. I've done a lot to promote small business, but it's time to go. 20 years is enough. And I think it's important for young people to get into this job and establish themselves, because it's a lot easier to get stuff done if you've been around for a while.
Alderman Brookins was also the point man regarding reparations for the torture victims of Burge, correct?
That's right. Yeah, one of several. And he was former head of the City Council's Black Caucus, which puts you kind of on the front lines of the ward remap. And the Black Caucus did very well in the last ward remap, kind of held on to a lot of seats despite population loss. Yeah. So yeah, he has a solid record. Was known for being pretty close to both mayors. He and Daley kind of had a break and then came back together for his second election. But yeah, I talked to him months before during his judicial run, and then after he had lost his bid, and he was basically like, I would like this job is all consuming in a way that other political jobs aren't. Your alderman is your direct line to complain to. He was like, I would like to be able to go to dinner with my family without being interrupted by a constituent talking to me about potholes or street lamps being out.
Yeah. A.D. Quigg is here, Chicago Tribune reporter. We're talking Chicago politics here. Add Alderman Brookins to the great city council exodus. Does this have anything to do with perhaps maxing out his aldermanic pension?
He has said no. And, you know, when people leave, it is never all one thing. But having a nice pension never hurts. And this is something we all pay attention to closely in Chicago, especially folks that have been around for a long time. It is going to be sizable. But a lot of these aldermen would argue, hey, I've put in my time. This is something I deserve to live off for a while. So no, and no alderman would tell you to your face, I'm maxing out and getting out. But I'll be interested to see the calculations that come out for, you know, all other, what are we up to now? 13, 14 folks who are leaving the city council, what their pension payout ends up being.
Yeah, what do you suppose in general, your thoughts on why so many are thinking, okay, it's just time to move on? Is it the loss of aldermanic prerogative? Is it the fact that they don't particularly like working with this mayor, although she may or may not be reelected? What do you suppose it is? Or it's just $142,000 a year, frankly, just isn't worth it.
It's a mix for everybody, and for everybody it's different. So for some, like Alderman Michelle Smith, it was family. Alderman Sue Sadlowski-Garza said the same thing. But when you talk to folks more casually, off the record, the mayor does play a role in this. Alderman, I think, even in the Emanuel days, when it was a very top-down controlling place, still felt like they were getting quite a bit done. Generally, if they were giving something up to the mayor, they were getting something back in exchange in the Emanuel and Daley years. But under Mayor Lightfoot, even Howard Brookins said this, it was hard to work with her, not alone for her personality, but because she was still kind of getting her sea legs and had never run an office this large before. So if not her personality, then some people were pointing to the fact that, you know, she'd never done this before, and put COVID on top of that, the demands of your constituents, so much need in the community. And a lot of folks told me, you know, my favorite part of the job is being face-to-face with constituents, and COVID stole that from me. And instead, I had to sit in these really long Zoom meetings where everyone was talking just for the sake of talking, and I felt like we weren't getting a lot done. It's just not as rewarding as it once was.
Who can't relate to that? In fact, I'll read from your piece. The pandemic struck him with long, boring meetings with people inventing things to say just to seem relevant. The meetings were longer. Everybody wanted to talk. That's from A.D. Quigg's piece in the Chicago Tribune. Other than his former longtime aide, Curtis Thompson, he pleaded guilty to taking about $7,500 in bribes to fix a liquor license. And I don't know how long ago that was. Is Brookins pretty clear of the stain of scandal? You know, when we're grading on a Chicago curve here, AD.
He's pretty clear that that scandal was back in 2015. His ex-aide was sentenced. I have not heard, and, you know, I'm not privy to what's going on in the U.S. Attorney's Office, to anything involving Brookins and this latest sting. But yes, I think that has also, all these federal indictments have also kind of cast a pall over how fun, I'm putting fun in air quotes, or enjoyable it is to serve as city council. If you harken back to when Alderman first found out that Danny Solis was wearing a wire, there was this like vast sense of betrayal on the council.
Yeah.
And they're under a lot more scrutiny than they were in past years, scrutiny and kind of suspicion from folks. And when I spoke to people a few months ago for a story on why so many aldermen were running for office and losing, there were some who were like, it's always been a tarnished name, but it seems especially tarnished now, not only because of the indictments, but because of Mayor Lightfoot speaking so poorly about how aldermen do their jobs at times.
A.D. Quigg, thank you very much. We appreciate it. I thought the profile on Alderman Brookins was excellent, and we'll see who else joins him in the train out of town, or out of City Hall, I should say. Yeah, there's going to be more.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Have a great evening.
This is John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
Meanwhile, R. Kelly's federal trial in Chicago resumed today with his former business manager on the stand. In fact, he's been there for about 6 hours over the past 2 days, I think. Daryl McDavid is trying to convince jurors, let's be honest, he's trying to convince one juror, that the payoffs to witnesses and attempts to round up all those problematic sex tapes were not a conspiracy. Really, that seems like a tough row to hoe. And I can't figure out why this guy hasn't rolled over for the feds long ago. Let's start there with Bob Chirito. He's a Chicago-based reporter working for the New York Times and covering the R. Kelly trial here in Chicago. Bob, why is this guy digging his heels in so dramatically when the evidence is so overwhelmingly against his story?
Well, I think, first of all, he would say that the evidence isn't so overwhelming and point to a lot of these witnesses who are, you know, shaky at best. You know, he testified for 2 days, 10 hours over 2 days, and really 9 hours and 50 minutes of it, they focused him on 2000 to 2008, where he was basically presented with documents and reports and other things that he said all confirmed to him that not only was Kelly telling him the truth about never having a relationship with Jane, the minor, but that Jane and her parents were also telling the truth when they repeatedly denied it in those years. The last 10 minutes of his testimony, it was fireworks went off when they asked him about, you know, since 2008, what he's learned. And he said, as I stand here today, I'm embarrassed and sad. And he said, the last 3 weeks, I've learned a lot of things that I had no idea about in 2008. Now, he did not go into specifics, but I expect the government to really focus on that tomorrow in cross-examination, which will start at 10 a.m.
That'll be interesting. So, Bob, did he say while he was collecting the tapes and passing out the cash, my verbiage, that he didn't think anything he was doing at that time was illegal?
Correct. His testimony was basically, he believed that it was a sex tape with Kelly and his wife and another woman who was an adult. And then he also testified there might have been one other sex tape with Kelly and a man, an adult male. But, no, you know, he said that there was absolutely no mention or no thought in his head that it could ever be a minor.
Okay, put the male tape aside for a moment. I haven't heard much about that. But back to the other tape that you referenced, do you think tomorrow a prosecutor might say, even then, back in those days, all those years ago, you must have realized that an R. Kelly sex tape is an enhancement to his career, will help sell more records, not hurt. I mean, it's just counterintuitive, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's a good argument. I think, you know, I think he had an interesting explanation was that Kelly told him he was concerned that he didn't want his kids to know that their mother was involved in this kind of tape. So I think both arguments have some merit.
No father wants their kids to know about it. What about the fact that, did he know that R. Kelly had used a fake driver's license to marry his 15-year-old niece?
That is not part of this trial and has been ruled, because he was tried on that in New York. That was part of the New York trial. So they can't talk about Aaliyah at all.
Nothing that happened in New York can be introduced in this trial?
Not really, even though it's all kind of related to the, you know, similar charges.
But who do you think is making a better argument, the prosecution or the defense, Bob?
Honestly, I think it's going to end up being a mixed result. I think that he's not going to be, in my opinion, he'll probably not be able to overcome the videos with Jane. But the charges related to the other minors, I think he might be found not guilty on. So I think, you know, it'll likely be a mixed verdict. But even if he's found guilty of just a few counts, he's probably going to have a hefty sentence.
Now, his sentence is hefty in the New York case, obviously. Is that under appeal, I assume?
Yes.
Okay.
And which is why they want to try him here. A lot of people are saying, why, if he has 30 years, are they wasting their time on a trial? I think they want to make sure that in case he beats that other case on appeal, he still would have to serve some kind of sentence.
Are you glad to leave the courtroom after hours and hours and hours and weeks and weeks of testimony, Bob?
Yeah, it's been a long day. Yes, you know, today was all McDavid. Yesterday was, we had a couple of people before he started, so there was a little bit of a breakup today. And tomorrow morning, it'll be McDavid for the cross-exam for the government, and who knows how long that will take.
Do they allow you to bring a pad to sit on?
No.
Well, I would advise a lot of handkerchiefs, I guess, in the back pockets then. Some papers, some newspapers, if you can bring those in.
Yeah. Or maybe sit on top of somebody who fell asleep.
Good luck. Then we'll be hearing about you in the news. Bob Chirito, thank you for bringing us up to date. We like the fact that you spent all the time there, so we don't have to. We'll talk to you, I'm sure, if not tomorrow, next week at some point.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Bob. Take care.
This is John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
Saw this in the Washington Monthly, but our guest writes for the Washington Monthly. He writes for Politico. He writes for Real Clear Politics. He joins a couple times a month, at least once a month. Let's see. After Sarah Palin lost in the special election to represent Alaska in the U.S. House, she blamed the state's new election process, ranked choice voting. She received 27%. She was not happy. Three other candidates advanced to the August general election. She did not suddenly denounce ranked choice voting. She didn't like it from the get-go. But she's been quite upset since the election. Now let's welcome back for a discussion Bill Scheer, a contributor, Washington Monthly and others, host of the history podcast When America Worked. Bill, welcome back. Thank you for hanging on. Much appreciated, sir. In red state Alaska, ranked choice voting should be an easy layup for somebody with name recognition like Sarah Palin.
Yeah, the Republicans have been kind of suspicious of ranked choice voting. And that was partly because when it was introduced in Maine, a Republican was person in the rural district, the second district, had won in 2014 with a plurality of about 47% of the vote. And then ranked choice voting comes in, and suddenly people's second and third preferences matter. And getting that first 47% wasn't sufficient. And that congressperson lost to the current congressman, Democrat Jared Golden. Now, Alaska is not Maine. Alaska is not as blue a state as Maine. You have a state where Republicans vastly outnumber registered Democrats, as has been pointed out. There are three people on the ballot this special election, one Democrat, two Republicans. You combine the Republican votes, you get to 60%. So they're frustrated that they still didn't win, but it's a reminder that there are plenty of Republicans available to win a ranked choice election. All Republicans had to do was rank one Republican number one and another Republican number two, and they would have the seat. The problem is that the Republican voters didn't choose to do that. That's where things break down, and it's a messaging problem for the Republican Party that they didn't tell their voters that it would make sense to do that.
Well, Palin was she kind of jumped into the race, and she has big name recognition, and she has her fans. But her fans are limited at 27%. I don't think she was very many people's second choice. That's her problem.
I mean, the idea of ranked choice voting, I don't like it. But the point of it is it makes it harder for a candidate who can only win a plurality faction to win the final election. If the person's support is intense but narrow, that's not good enough to win a ranked choice election. You need to have broader support than that. And so, you know, she was campaigning in part against the whole system. She was telling her own voters, don't comply. Don't bother ranking your choices. That's not how you win a ranked choice election. You got to play the game the way the rules are set. The person who did win, Mary Pottola, she was literally identifying people who were avowed supporters of Palin or the other Republican baggage, going up to them and saying, you know, great that's your first choice. Think of me for your number two. That's how you win a ranked choice election. Palin chose not to try to do that. Whether she could even do it if she tried is also a question, because she's a very controversial person.
Back to my previous statement, she has her 27%, and that's the ceiling as far as, you know, and if she can't win in Alaska, that should tell you something as well.
Well, this is the question. Let's say you didn't have ranked choice voting. Let's say you had a system. Or put that aside. Let's say just a regular primary. Palin wins a Republican primary, and she's in a general election with Mary Pottola. Does she win that? You can't assume that she would have gotten those baggage voters if there was a second election down the line. The problem was that a lot of baggage voters didn't like Sarah Palin. That's the big problem there. So they may have simply not shown up to vote in a separate election or voted for Pottola anyway. All ranked choice voting does is compress the process into a single day's election, not spread over two elections. So Republicans need to think long and hard about why is it that their favorite Republican could not hold on to Republican votes.
Bingo. There you go. Thank you, Bill Scherr. Excellent analysis. Great column. Washington Monthly. We'll talk to you again. Also, you're the host of the History Podcast, When America Worked. Thanks for your time this afternoon. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That harms the entire nation. So I think the entire country should be angry at what's going on with this establishment system. And it was the political establishment that created this system with the ranked choice voting and without encouraging the other Republican to drop out once he got thumped three times. Others should be outraged about what's going on here, because our system is harming the rest of the U.S.
That is a rhetorical bebop.
This is John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
My phone rang earlier today. Man, it was Commissioner Gordon calling Batman. And it was our director of programming, Stephanie Tischner, saying, OMG, 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 the Queen has died. And I said, well, yeah, she was 96. And Stephanie said, you don't understand how important this is. This is a monumental event. I am very upset about it. And most of us are. And why aren't you? And I said, well, she was 96, and I'm not one of her subjects. You know, my friends back in 1776 took care of that. But I said, I admire her, and she did a nice job. And by all accounts, she's 96. That's a pretty good run. And Stephanie said, don't you remember how impactful her COVID speech was from 2020? And I said, no. And she said, I want to hear that on your show today. And I said, okay.
I'm speaking to you at what I know is an increasingly challenging time, a time of disruption in the life of our country, a disruption that has brought grief to some, financial difficulties to many, and enormous changes to the daily lives of us all.
It was a terrific speech, and I especially like the part where she told her subjects from Australia through Canada, South Africa, the entire Commonwealth, hey, buck up!
I hope in the years to come, everyone will be able to take pride in how they responded to this challenge. And those who come after us will say the Britons of this generation were as strong as any, that the attributes of self-discipline, of quiet, good-humored resolve, and of fellow feeling still characterize this country.
Well, she certainly characterized that, so keep calm and carry on.
We will succeed, and that success will belong to every one of us. We should take comfort that while we may have more still to endure, better days will return. We will be with our friends again. We will be with our families again. We will meet again.
Let the record show that I caved into management yet again. Now let's go to my brother in sound, Steve Cochran, host of the Steve Cochran Show, mornings from 5:30 to 9 here on the Big 89. Steve, I had heard through the grapevine you were quite distraught. How are you doing, my friend?
Well, one thing that strikes me is how mean your boss sounds. I don't know about this one. She sounds very difficult, very demanding. No, I think I'm probably where you are. I mean, I'm saddened by it, but 96 and 70 years on the throne, that's a heck of a run. And she had dignity and grace and honor, and every other leader on the planet ought to try a little more of those three things.
Why are so many women still mad at Meghan?
Yeah, I don't know. I think we have to get behind closed doors. It certainly is our business, don't you think, get right in the middle of their marriage. But I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I do think that the family behind those palace doors was just as screwed up as everybody else's family, maybe more in some ways. I don't know. People took comfort in watching the Real Housewives meltdown. you would think they'd take comfort in watching the royal family have real life struggles. I don't know. I don't know a lot tonight.
Is Bernard Shaw today's Farrah Fawcett?
Oh, man. How about dying on the wrong day? Right?
Yeah. That guy was a Chicagoan. He was a very good anchorman, a news reporter, beat reporter, what have you, long career. Not quite 70 years, but nonetheless a long career. When I woke up this morning, I thought, well, I have to dedicate a couple of segments, I think, to Bernard Shaw, considering his Chicago roots. He was born and raised here. And, 90 minutes later, no, DEFCON 1 on the Queen.
Right. I met him a couple of times. He was a good dude. And do you remember, we both are old enough to have lived in a time where there was no internet and phones were attached to a wall. And Bernard Shaw was in that hotel.
Yes.
And announced the beginning of the Iraq war live on CNN. And we thought, we'll never see anything like this again. Now, if we don't get the announcement of starts of anything as it's happening, or maybe before anyone even thought of it, we're mad.
I noticed that Wolf Blitzer, CNN has already dispatched Wolf Blitzer. He's standing in front of Buckingham Palace right now. It's the middle of the night out there, but now all hands on deck for the next few days in London.
What's it? I have a very good friend in London who's on the show the whole time, Paul Coit. He'll be on tomorrow. But they're doing 10 days of mourning, and I don't entirely understand. Maybe you do. Do they shut everything down for 10 days, or is it just a respectful period of time where you're all supposed to reflect on how you feel? I don't know.
I don't know either. I don't know. Who's Camilla now? Is she the queen in waiting?
She's
her role?
Queen consort, which sounds like trouble, doesn't it?
It does. It sounds like that's illegal.
And when does Prince Charles actually become King Charles? He's King Charles now, but when do they actually do that particular ceremony? We don't know a lot of things, John. We don't know a lot of things tonight.
I was asking my listeners, and no doubt yours too today, I said, I don't quite understand, and I say this satirically in regards to Stephanie and others, but the emotional reaction to the death of the Queen, what does that tell us? That America has royal fantasies or fetishes, with all due respect, or are we trying to fill some sort of cultural void that we don't have here since Jackie O passed away? Is she the last of the really admired, untainted royals? What is it about this?
I don't know as well, and this will be the 12th time I've said I don't know, but it does seem more of a gender split there, right? Have you come across any men that have said they have that sort of royal family following? Now, having said that, The Crown is a really good show, and you ought to watch it.
My wife loved it. She watched every episode. I watched the first maybe four or five episodes, and later on, I saw a couple, and I understand that it's very, very good. Those series just seem to go on just way, 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 way too long, and I think every episode is too long. You know, David Chase with The Sopranos, he said once, Steve, that it was a blessing that they had to work for HBO because HBO said, okay, 65 minutes, 66, 67, and that's it. Everything else hits the floor, so make it good. And now no longer with Netflix and some of these other streaming services, these shows don't work under the constraints, and it just gets very gratuitous, and it's just too much.
It goes on and on and on. By the way, The Sopranos, this goes back to I don't know, sometime around the end of the series. I got a leather jacket and I still have some hair and I'm jogging. Yes, running, trotting, if you will.
You?
Across Daily Plaza.
For a TV commercial or something? I mean, you don't run.
Well, I did in this case. And shockingly, I was late for a meeting. And a homeless fella yells out, "Hey, Tony Soprano." And I turned around and went over to him and said, "Well, how'd you get cable?"
Oh,
because I'm still trying to figure that part of it out. But very funny line by him. Look, I am saddened by this, but I think you and I are on the same page. It's a sad thing, but it's also a pretty incredible thing that she did what she did for 70 years. And I hope it's a celebration of her life, not just 10 days of mourning.
Honestly, it's not that sad. It's the beginning, it's the middle, and now the end. Who do you like in tonight's NFL game?
Bills.
Yeah, that's my heart's with the Bills. I think I hope they win tonight. I wish they had won the Super Bowl. Mr. Cochran, thank you. I'll be listening tomorrow morning to listen for your friend from London. I appreciate your time here.
Thanks for coming on, bud. We'll talk to you on my show on Monday.
Okay, take care.
John Howell, Essential Cuts. Check back every weekday for another episode of John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
When you have sports mixed with your pop culture, along with humor and celebrity interviews, your earbuds are enjoying the Rich Eisen Show.
Kevin Millar, we're all paying rent in Ohtani's world, right?
And the Dodgers world. Game is healthy. Game is good. And, you know, I get asked a lot, is that good for baseball? Yeah, it's good for baseball. This is definitely the team to beat, because that should be your next correction, Richie, is this World Series a bust for the Dodgers and Dave Roberts?
Hell yeah. Search for the Rich Eisen Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.